Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used by somebody who was psychopathic.
Let's tell this story.
World of Secrets, Season 2, The Disciples. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, January the 11th, these are our main stories. Israel is accused of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. We hear from the International Court of Justice in The Hague and have a furious response from a former advisor to the Israeli Prime Minister. China issues a stark warning to voters in Taiwan 2 days before they go to the polls to elect a new president. And Bitcoin goes mainstream in the US. Will that help end the wild volatility of cryptocurrencies? Also in this podcast, the perfume in Italy that for many may reek of a violent and bloody past. And...
Whoa! That is some group of people. Thousands!
The skyscraper that's helped define Donald Trump and that he may be about to lose. There have been heated exchanges between rival supporters of Israel and the Palestinians outside the International Court of Justice in The Hague. They'd gathered for the hearing of a case brought by South Africa, which alleges that Israel's military offensive in Gaza amounts to genocide. A crowd watching a live stream of the hearing chanted slogans including, "Israel is a terror state. Free, free Palestine." Well, inside the court, a lawyer representing South Africa, Adila Hassim, set out the reasons for calling Israel's actions in Gaza genocide.
Israel has now damaged or destroyed an estimated 355,000 Palestinian homes, leaving at least 500,000 Palestinians with no home to return to. The Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons explains that houses and infrastructure, quote, have been razed to the ground, frustrating any realistic prospects for displaced Gazans to return home, repeating a long history of mass forced displacement of Palestinians by Israel.
Well, Israel has dismissed the case as baseless. For an Israeli view of it, we've been hearing from Caroline Glick, a former foreign policy advisor to Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. She's been talking to Rob Young.
First of all, 86% of the Palestinians, not only in Gaza, but in the West Bank as well, support the atrocities of October 7th. This is surveys taken by the Palestinians themselves, not by Israel. And the notion that when Israeli Jews say things like this, that it means that we're carrying out a genocide, whereas nothing of that sort, no obscenity like this would ever be launched against any other people on the face of the earth, tells you exactly what the nature of the allegations are by the South Africans and exactly what the nature of the ICJ is.
Right. Now, in addition to the large death toll, which the Hamas-run health ministry puts at more than 23,000, we know that 300,000 homes in the Gaza Strip have been damaged or destroyed. Infrastructure has been damaged. 85% of people have been displaced. The Supreme Court, universities, the public archive, other public buildings have been destroyed. At the very least, would you accept the military response has been disproportionate, effectively over the top, if not genocidal?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. Israel's military response to a genocidal attack by a genocidal army whose declared purpose is the annihilation of the Jewish people has been to go out and root and branch, root out Hamas's military infrastructure. And you know the funny thing is that in every single private home that Israel has entered, they have found weapons, they have found Kalashnikov rifles, they have found RPGs, they found them in children's beds, they found them in schools, in mosques, in hospitals. Every single aspect of Gaza, the infrastructure of that regime and that people were mobilized fully on behalf of the commitment of genocide against Israel. You go into an Israeli house, you don't find RPGs in the trundles of children's bed. You find comforters and blankets and stuffed animals, but not in Gaza. You open up the rooms of children, you look at their backpacks with Hello Kitty on them, and you find IEDs.
When you say there are weapons in children's cots and the like, are you suggesting that that makes children legitimate targets?
I'm saying that when you use civilian targets to carry out military operations under binding international law, that site becomes a military target. When you're dealing with an illegal terrorist organization whose goal, whose sine qua non, its reason for existing, is to eliminate your people, and you find that the entire infrastructure of life in that area, in Gaza, is mobilized and organized around the single purpose of killing you and your children, then you understand the nature of the enemy that Israel's fighting.
That's Caroline Glick. Well, our correspondent Anna Hologan is in The Hague and has been attending the hearing.
In court today, South Africa laid out some of the evidence, it said, of Israel's violation of the Genocide Convention, including pointing to the mass killing of Palestinians in military bombardments, deliberate displacement of huge swathes of the population, the creation of what South Africa described as siege conditions calculated to bring about the Palestinians' physical destruction, if not in bombings, then through starvation, dehydration, or lack of access to medical help. They also referenced statements which they said were of genocidal intent by Israeli officials. All of this taken together, South Africa argues, represents a deliberate attempt by Israel to erase, in whole or part, the Palestinian population in Gaza. And so they have asked the judges to urgently intervene to issue this injunction. They're asking the judges to urge Israel to stop its military campaign.
Now, the Israelis will give their testimony tomorrow, but they strongly deny the accusations, don't they?
Absolutely. Israel has described these accusations as baseless. We heard from Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday evening. He said that there was no intention by Israel to remove Palestinians from Gaza or permanently occupy the Strip. But what we're witnessing here is an increasing desire by different countries to use this court as a forum to try and exert influence over these types of conflicts. And we saw the same with Russia and Ukraine. We saw the same with China and Myanmar. And the judges have limited powers, so they can issue preliminary measures, interim measures, within weeks, possibly. And that is not the same as a ruling on the fundamentals, whether or not Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. There is a potential, though, for any ruling against Israel to have a political, diplomatic, international impact in terms of the kinds of support and opposition to what's happening in Gaza right now.
Anna Hologan in The Hague. With less than 2 days to go before the people of Taiwan go to the polls to elect a new president, China has unveiled a new vision for an economic and cultural future unified with the self-governing island. It's Beijing's latest attempt to influence voters in Taiwan, which it claims is Chinese territory and has vowed to retake it by force if necessary. Under Xi Jinping's leadership, Beijing has taken an ever sharper and often more aggressive tone towards Taiwan, warning the world that it alone will decide how and when unification will happen. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker has this report.
We've made it to the closest point on the Chinese mainland to Taiwan. This is on Pingtan Island. There's a busload of Chinese tourists making the love heart sign in front of the lighthouse. You can only really make out a wee bit of Taiwan, just a rock in the distance, but the rest is lost in fog.
My biggest wish after visiting here is that I hope the island of Taiwan can return to our motherland soon. This feeling has become stronger while I am here.
61-year-old Sui Xiaowen has travelled hundreds of miles from the northwest of China just for a glimpse of Taiwan.
Even if Taiwan is taken back, I hope it's done via peaceful negotiations. In this way, there is no harm inflicted. If there is a war, the casualties will be huge. We want peace.
The blustery, rocky outcrop, marked as 68 nautical miles from Taiwan, is as close as people from mainland China can get. The government banned individual tourists from travelling to the self-governed island back in 2019. But some who live and work here on China's Pingtan Island rarely think about their neighbour, which is just a few hours away by boat. Dozens of local workers huddled together out of the wind, trying to sort abalone shells for harvesting. They barely look up as they speak to us. They need to keep working to earn money.
I don't care whether it's reunified or not. It's up to the officials. We just want enough to eat.
I'm walking down what is known as the three lanes and seven alleys. These are beautiful wooden traditional houses bedecked with red lanterns. Many Taiwanese are thought to be descendants of people from this province. Beijing often uses these ties as an argument for integration, as part of a vision for China's unified future. Do you think there's a special relationship between the people here in this province?
There are communications between the two sides, and in the future we will become like a family.
As they sing about love on the streets here, many doubt that Beijing will want a war on its doorstep as it battles an economic downturn. China is trying to entice the people of Taiwan to its shores with a message of familial love. But as it continues to carry out raw displays of military power around the island, the sound of warships will likely drown out any acts of wooing.
Laura Bicker reporting there. Now to Italy, where a new perfume has been making headlines, perhaps more for the taste it leaves in the mouth rather than its smell. Launched by the TikTok star Nunzia Giuliano, Olio is a fragrance named after her father, Carmine Giuliano, an infamous mafia boss in Naples, otherwise known as the Lion. He's seen as a local folk hero by some. Nunzia has already sold out her first batch of perfume. But for other people, it reeks of a violent and bloody past. Tom Kington is the Times newspaper's correspondent in Rome. He's been telling me what's so controversial about Carmine Giuliano.
He was a member of the infamous Giuliano clan, which was pretty dominant amongst the local mafia clans in Naples in the 80s, the so-called Camorra mafia in the city. There were lots of them, lots of brothers, and Carmine stood out because he was quite a charismatic figure. So apart from dealing in drugs and extortion, this was a family that made friends with a local footballer at the time, Diego Maradona, the Argentine star, who was playing for the local team Napoli at the time. And there are some very sort of iconic photographs of Diego Maradona posing with the Giuliano brothers, including Carmine, in their luxury pad in Naples. So he's gone down in history as both a gangster, but as you said, a sort of folk hero. I mean, we got to remember that mafia bosses in cities like Naples are often loved because they're seen as sort of bestowing welfare upon poor residents. So perhaps if you're out of money, you'll go to them, they'll give you a turkey for Christmas, or they'll help you with a loan. Always comes at a price, but nevertheless they have that kind of dual reputation.
Some strange kind of nostalgia amongst some people, but I imagine there are a lot of critics. What are people saying about this perfume particularly?
Well, it has prompted some very fierce criticism from an Italian MP, Francesco Emilio Borelli, who said, and I quote, he said that Carmine's daughter, Nunzia, who has promoted this perfume, is trying to push the image of a man as a saint and a hero, whereas we'd do well to remember he was a member of the Camorra Mafia, and he was a guy that you were well advised to stay clear of.
Tom Kington of The Times. Still to come, we meet the top 10 weird and wonderful species discovered in 2023.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Are County Mayo a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend?
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety. If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van with a sweet solar-powered kitchenette and space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC, ambitions made real.
The cryptocurrency industry has been given a major boost after US financial regulators finally cleared some major investment funds to start trading on stock exchanges. The approval of what are known as exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, is seen by supporters as a watershed moment for crypto. Joe Tidy is our cyber reporter.
An ETF is a way to invest in something without actually buying it. So, for example, you could have a pot of funds, a portfolio of funds of, let's say, tech giant shares mixed in with insurance company shares or a bit of gold bullion or silver bullion. And I would buy shares in this ETF. That way, when the price and the value of those shares or materials go up or down, I benefit or obviously lose out as well. So I'm effectively allowing myself to be a part of the, I've got skin in the game without actually having to go through the process of buying these shares or these materials. And now, of course, Bitcoin.
Now, this move was resisted for some time because of concerns about fraud and manipulation. Is this seminal moment for cryptocurrency now? Is it going to be more stable now?
A lot of people are saying that, yes. I think there's been so much excitement about ETFs. They're more specifically called spot ETFs because previously there have been Bitcoin investments in ETFs as part of futures trading, which is not quite the same. It's an indirect way of being of having exposure to Bitcoin. But now with the spot Bitcoin ETFs, what we're seeing is we're going to see all these massive investment firms in the US. So there are 11 of them that have applied to do this. They're all going to start literally buying up Bitcoin and storing that and having that as part of their custodian, as part of the portfolio for each ETF that they're selling to their customers. So a lot of people are very excited, and they have been for a few months now in the crypto world, because we are going to see billions of dollars poured into buying Bitcoin. And then, of course, a potential rejuvenation of the cryptocurrency industry as a whole, because we've had this about a year and a half has been what's been described as the crypto winter, where the price of one Bitcoin went right down to about $16,000 from a high of $70,000. And we saw all these scandals in the industry. And then this discussion of the spot ETFs reared its head about 6 months ago, and it's just got bigger and bigger. And the price of Bitcoin has risen as a result of that. And people are excited about the fact that if you've got a healthy Bitcoin market, if one coin is worth a lot, suddenly you've got a lot more people spending money in general on the cryptocurrency industry, which can be quite exciting with the kind of products that you can build based on this technology of blockchain.
Joe Tidy. Now, there is a lot of excitement in the run-up to this weekend as football teams from across the continent head to Ivory Coast for the Africa Cup of Nations. But Gambia's squad have already faced difficulties before even getting there. Their plane had to turn around after 9 minutes in the air because of a lack of oxygen, with passengers falling asleep and feeling dizzy. Here's our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
According to the Gambia's Belgian coach, Tom Samfeet, the local crew in Banjul said there was a problem with the air conditioning on the flight, but that it would be fine once they were airborne. But shortly after taking off, he said people, including himself, started falling asleep, with players complaining of extreme dizziness and headaches. He said they were in danger of dying from carbon monoxide poisoning, a claim that's been disputed by the Gambian Football Federation's president, who was also on the flight. The plane was forced to turn around, and the squad is now recovering in Banjul, waiting for another aircraft to take them to Ivory Coast for the competition. It had already been a troubled build-up for the Gambia, with players refusing to train over what they claimed were unpaid bonuses, although that issue is said to have been resolved. Their first match in Ivory Coast is on Monday, when they take on the Africa Cup of Nations defending champions, Senegal.
Alex Capstick. Donald Trump is expected back in court in New York today as closing arguments begin in the civil fraud trial that threatens the former president's business empire. His lawyers are going to seek to convince the judge, who will decide the case, that he should not be barred from doing business in New York City and that he should retain control of his properties like Trump Tower. The BBC's New York correspondent, Neda Torfik, takes a look at how that skyscraper has defined Donald Trump's brand and what losing it would mean.
Few buildings have been so closely tied to its owner in the public imagination as this Trump Tower. Built in the 80s era of excess, the atrium boasts pink marble and brass, a design that was meant to exude wealth and to announce the arrival of the real estate developer Donald Trump to Manhattan and the world.
Donald, now that you've completed the finest residential address in the world, perhaps, what do you do for an encore?
Its style, now outdated, was once celebrated and became central to Trump's identity.
Former Forbes researcher and writer Jonathan Greenberg said the year before Trump Tower was completed, Trump lied about his assets to make it onto their richest Americans list, claiming a net worth of $100 million, when in reality, he was worth less than $5 million.
We in the media were unprepared for anyone who lies as effectively and shamelessly as Donald Trump.
Okay, what's your first name, then, John?
Infamously, in a 1984 phone call with Greenberg, Trump pretended to be a fake executive at his organization.
Most of the assets have been consolidated to Mr. Trump, you know, because you have Trump.
In hindsight, Greenberg believes Trump knew being on the list would be game-changing for his borrowing power and image. Even while he was facing spectacular financial losses in the early 90s, he was appearing in Hollywood as a wealthy business tycoon.
Excuse me, where's the lobby?
Down the hall and to the left.
Thanks.
That image stuck, and in 2005, he reinvented himself as a reality star on The Apprentice, which was set in his Fifth Avenue property.
You're fired. You're fired. You're fired.
On the other side of that famous catchphrase, the contestants in a mock boardroom. The show set the stage for his White House run, which began with a history-making ride down the golden escalator in Trump Tower's atrium to announce his plans.
Wow. Whoa. That is some group of people. Thousands. So nice.
In reality, there were only a few dozen spectators here. But over the course of the campaign, the size of his rallies grew, culminating in a shocking and divisive election victory. Overnight, Trump Tower became the de facto presidential transition office in the same space where The Apprentice was filmed. But it also became the scene of frequent protests. His presidency ultimately killed his image in New York and led to scrutiny of his business practices. His longtime friend and fellow real estate developer, who testified for the defense in the trial, Steve Witkoff, insists Trump didn't do anything wrong and will never stop fighting to save his empire and Trump Tower.
But I think if the end result was he lost it, he would feel it would be an indignity. But hopefully we're not going to get to that place.
Congratulations. Good job.
Ready to bring coffee?
I love you, Dad.
Trump Tower has become a mecca to his supporters, who often leave with his political merchandise. Losing this building would be an epic chapter in his downfall in this city. But equally, if it is unaffected by this case, it will stand as a monument to its developers' ability to endure.
Neda Torfik. There is still no word on when Boeing's fleet of 737 MAX 9 aircraft will be allowed to fly again. Almost 200 aircraft have been grounded since a panel blew off one flight in mid-air, causing depressurization of the cabin and terrified passengers' possessions to be sucked out at almost 5,000 metres altitude. Miraculously, everybody on board survived. Inspections have since found multiple examples of loose parts on other 737 MAX 9 planes in the latest safety concerns related to the 737 MAX fleet. The chair of the US Senate Subcommittee on Aviation Safety is Senator Tammy Duckworth. She told Rob Young that there were still many questions to be answered.
This raises questions about everything from the program that exists that allows for self-certification that had happened in the past, and then also to the incident here with the cockpit door that popped open. Apparently, that, according to Boeing, is a design feature, but was not in the manual. So the two pilots on this flight did not know that their cockpit door was going to fly open if there was a decompression that happened.
So once the 737 MAX 9 is back in the air, because I don't think there's any suggestion that it won't be back in the air at some point, however long that takes, are you sufficiently confident that Boeing makes its planes in the way it ought to, that you would get on that plane happily and would feel safe?
I fly on that plane on a regular basis. I am confident in the maintenance process. And obviously, since I'm the one that's getting on it and I am the chair of the aviation subcommittee, I'm going to make sure it's as safe as it can possibly be.
Now, you would like there to be a new law which would require the Federal Aviation Administration to change emergency evacuation procedures when it comes to emergency landings, like we saw in the case of this Alaska Airlines plane. Why is that needed?
Well, the FAA has been certifying that we can evacuate aircraft within 90 seconds. And that is a standard set in the 1960s. And it turned out they were only putting 60 passengers in the aircraft. Nobody under the age of 18, nobody over the age of 60, nobody with a disability, no carry-on baggage. So in this new FAA authorization bill that we're about to pass out of Congress, I actually have inserted a requirement for the FAA to develop new standards that will include things like persons with disabilities, children, elderly, people who are hearing impaired, people who don't speak English. I want to know how long it takes. And we just had an example with the Japan Airlines flight where everything went as well as it could possibly have been, and that was 5 minutes, not 90 seconds.
That was Senator Tammy Duckworth. From an underground forest to spectacular orchids, scientists say they've discovered 74 new mysterious plants and fungi over the last year. Many were found in unlikely places like the top of a volcano or clinging to Antarctic rocks. But it looks as if some of them are already facing extinction, if indeed they're not already extinct. Among them is the Pinanga subterranea, a palm that grows underground with fruit. William Baker is from the research team at the Royal Botanical Gardens in Kew, London.
This was an absolutely amazing find that we made back in 2018 and we described for the first time last year. It came about because of a tip-off from a Malaysian collaborator of ours. And I was in the field in the middle of Borneo with a couple of fantastic students. And we stumbled across this palm he'd pointed us to that was a tiny little thing like a seedling on the ground with no sign of really anything much going on. And we thought maybe this is his mystery underground palm. And we started digging and we found flowers and fruits buried deep underground. It kind of makes no sense whatsoever. It never shows its flowers and fruits above the ground at all. We really still don't know what's out there. There are so many undescribed species out there in nature, and it's really urgent business to find out what they are, where they are, what their populations are like, and how close they are to extinction. That the tragedy is that with plants, we believe that perhaps three quarters of the undescribed plant species out there may already be threatened with extinction. We don't know what any given species does in nature. We don't know its part in the mechanism of how ecosystems work. We don't know what they can bring to us in terms of food or medicine.
That was biologist Dr. William Baker. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pat Sissons and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van with a sweet solar-powered kitchenette and space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC, ambitions made real.